Hey, Wonder Fam, welcome back to another episode of the Wonderful Design Podcast. So today we have one of the most seasoned product leaders we've ever interviewed on the show, Darren Guarnacha, who is currently the Senior Vice President of Hootsuite. Darren has over 20 years of experience in product marketing and product management. And at one of his earliest roles, he was employee number 30 at Sitecore, where he served for 10 years, supporting the company's growth to $200 million in annual revenue and a valuation at over $1 billion. He's also served as the Chief Marketing Officer for Lytics and Chief Product Officer at Crown Peak, where he has strategically built partnerships in industry analytics, establishing the company as the visionary in the Gartner Magic Quadrant. Across his tenure as the Senior Vice President of Hootsuite, Darren has reversed the company's halted growth, creating double-digit revenue growth, and launching the company's first new product in 5 years. He's also led the company to become recognized by Forbes Advisor as Best Social Media Management Software of 2022, achieved the highest Net Promoter Score in company history, and received multiple accolades from G2, including Top 50 Enterprise Product, Top 100 Global Sellers, and Top 100 Highest Satisfaction Products. What a phenomenal list of accomplishments. I've actually had to shorten down his bio just to give you guys the top of the top highlights of Darren's career accomplishments. So Darren, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. So we start every podcast episode with a rapid fire round. Darren, are you ready?
I am ready.
Awesome. So Darren, where did you grow up?
Grew up on the East Coast in New Jersey.
East Coast, New Jersey. And where are you now?
I'm actually on the left coast, the West Coast in Oregon.
Awesome. The best coast. And what's the book that you think everyone should read?
Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman.
Awesome. Thinking Fast and...
No, Thinking Fast and Slow. It's all about how the brain is wired.
Gotcha. Okay. And what is one app you cannot live without?
Instacart. I never want to go to a grocery store again or Costco.
I love Instacart. It saves so much time. And what do you think is the best invention of all time?
Airplanes. Airplanes. It makes the world a smaller place and lets you see more of it.
I love that. That's so true. And what is your favorite accomplishment of all time?
I think it was at Sitecore when we sort of reinvented the web content management market into the experience management market and really kind of turned the whole marketplace on its head. It was super fun.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to bookmark that because I definitely want to dive into it a little bit more. But one more question. What's your biggest challenge that you're working on right now?
I'm helping a couple companies kind of redefine their strategy and really create the right focus for their ideal customer profile. And I think that is the hardest thing to do because you want to solve everything for everybody. But, you know, strategy is what you don't do. And that's what Michael Porter said. And I believe it's about focus. And so getting companies to focus on the right strategy is what I'm working on right now.
So how do you get, let's get started. So how do you get a team to stay focused, especially if you're managing, right now you mentioned you're managing a team of over 90 folks at Hootsuite. So how do you get everyone to be focused and rowing in the same direction efficiently and effectively?
I think it starts with a central vision. Like what do you stand for? What do you believe as a product, as a company? What is it that you are trying to change in the world and make better? And I always talk about the word outcomes, you know, and outcomes for your customer, outcomes for the business. Like what are you trying to do beyond just making money? What are you trying to really do and change? And what gets better when your solution is used beautifully? And so it's about aligning to that vision, aligning to those outcomes and really anchored in sort of the customer need and the customer problem.
Oftentimes that's really hard to do, right? Because so many product leaders and engineers, they're really focused on the features or outputs. So tell us a little bit more about this outcome versus outputs and how you can actually build for your customers.
Yeah, another great book is Outcomes Over Outputs, and it's really about how to think about outcomes. And you know, a lot of times we just take what customers say at face value and say, "I need the blue button. Give me the blue button," and we just want to serve that customer and just do that. But what we really should do is ask why. and why should be the primary vocabulary of a product person's, you know, everyday language. It needs to be like, you need to understand why they want the blue button. What are they trying to solve? And as you dig in and you unpack that, you get to the actual problem they're trying to solve. And then you start to solve the problem. Because sometimes, you know, you have 50 different feature requests, but when you unpack them, they all kind of go down to the root problem that's all the same. And so maybe you can solve that problem beautifully across many customer needs by understanding the why. And so that's why I talk about outcomes all the time, because you understand what people are really trying to achieve with your solution. What is it that, what is the job to be done that they are hiring your product to solve? You really understand that and you can be solving for that, then you'll have way more impact than just checking the box and building a bunch of features.
And how do you get there, right? Because there's so many ways to ask the why, but you also have to think about the timeline of how to get there, right? So for you, what's been successful to get to that outcome?
I think a lot of it has to do with is really getting product teams out to the customers and really spending time with customers. Yet there are tools like Gong that also really help you understand the sales side of that equation. There are great tools that understand like how products are being used, like Full Story is a great example of watching customers, how they're using your product. But there is no substitute for getting on calls and running interviews and discovery calls with your customers about how do they work? Like, what's their work process? Like, what does that workflow look like? How are they doing all those tasks? How do they all hang together? What happens before they enter your product? What happens after they leave your product? And really understanding the full workflow of what it is they're doing with you. When you really get the empathy for that entire work process, you really understand their problem set. That's, I think, when the lights really go on. And how you get there is you spend time talking to customers. And one of the things I asked my team to do at one point was at least have 5 customer conversations every quarter, at least 5. I'd really like you to have 20. I'd like you to spend way more time talking to customers and less time in the scrum, because a lot of times it's very comfortable getting in the scrum, writing stories, doing that sort of work. But really the value happens when you're actually either in a customer's office, watching them work in their natural environment, bringing them into your office, listening and watching them, or just like getting on the calls with them with customer advisory boards, customer councils, all of those things that really help you understand how people are using your product in anger.
Yeah, it's definitely such a core part of delivering great product. I get surprised when I talk to some companies, you know, through our agency, and research or talking to the users is just not part of their process. It's really fascinating how some of these product companies still exist without, you know, talking to the users, talking to your customers, and really solving that problem, as you said, for what they're trying to get done.
Yeah. I would say even a blind squirrel finds an acorn now and again. You can get lucky. You can get lucky. You can trip over a solution. You know, I think one of the smartest things that we put in place at Hootsuite was a user research function, a dedicated user research function. Many times that lives in design, organically. It just happens to the part of a designer's work. But having a dedicated user research function that really serves product and design together, that's a very smart mechanic, because then that really gets proactive about what things do we need to learn about our customers, and you can really build a backlog of all the research you need to do versus it being sort of side of desk for a designer as they're doing some other piece of work.
How did that user research function come out to be? Was that during your tenure there? And how do you advocate an organization to invest into user research?
So that actually happened. It was originally just, again, part of the side of desk work and design. We actually split it out and moved it into product marketing, which is unorthodox. But we wanted to put it in product marketing because we thought that the natural bridge between product and design could happen there. And it could also serve the rest of the business, because it can also inform and marry the buyer research with the user research. Because sometimes those things are also really separate, when really you still need to be designing for both buyers and users. And so by putting that there, it was sort of the crossroads between design, product, and marketing and sales. And that really helped us. So how do you justify and argue for it? Well, I think the cost of not doing it is very high. Getting it wrong is very expensive. And so if you can be using user research to either be prototyping things out early, paper prototyping, doing lightweight tests, you know, understanding things and not writing a bunch of code that didn't work, that's really expensive. So you justify it by not writing the wrong thing.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, once you have that number out on paper, it makes a lot of sense. Like, hey, we're trying to save money in the long run. But a lot of companies, they don't see that. They're always thinking about like, oh, that's a huge investment for us. Let's just go and build. So that's a really great way to save money, definitely in the long run. So let's skip over. I want to learn a little bit more about your experience at Sitecore, because you mentioned that, you know, one of your favorite all-time accomplishment is shifting the Sitecore from web content management to experience management space. What does that actually mean? And how did you and your team get to disrupting the market?
So this is 2007. And the market had sort of commoditized again. Everyone was publishing web pages, you know, tools like FrontPage were coming out, Dreamweaver were coming out, where it's even simpler. And so it was really becoming harder and harder to justify its expensive enterprise systems around like publishing web pages, right? Even if it's very easy to do, it was hard. So we looked around and we said, you know, what's really happening here is people are visiting these websites so they can learn about your products, so they can, you know, interact with you as a brand. And it sort of occurred to us, that's really customer experience. And no one was really talking about customer experience back then. It was all just, you know, web pages and how fast can you publish web pages. It was all a lot of very speeds and feeds kind of talk. And so we sat down and we said, you know, we can actually rethink this whole market and really talk about web experience and ultimately customer experience management as a way to unify what's going on in web, what's going on in email, under, you know, incorporating analytics, which back then was a very separate thing. We said it needs to be incorporated into the whole solution. And so we started to stitch all these common pieces together that were happening in every project. We saw that again and again, customers were putting them together in every project. And we said, this is silly that we make customers stitch these together every time. Let's put this all in one unified platform. We'll make this for the marketer. And then we'll build a platform that marketers can control customer experience on their websites or emails and other channels. And that was really the first that anyone had really thought that way. And then of course, you know, just about a year after that, Adobe acquired a couple of companies. They acquired Day Software for web. They acquired Omniture for the analytics and so on and so forth. And that really got the momentum in the market. But it was fun to be the first mover. It was fun to realize that, hey, there's a bigger opportunity to talk about a broader story than just how fast can you publish a web page.
Yeah. And did you realize that you guys were one of the first movers in that space? What does that feel like?
Not at all. This is pure hindsight. I read a book a couple of years ago called Play Bigger about category creation. And had I realized back then that what we were really doing, I might have been a bit smarter about it. But it really was category creation. We had just invented a new category that was a superset of our current category. We were, you know, back then in the web content management publishing space, and we created the super category of experience management. But I had no idea we were doing this at the time. It just felt like the right thing to do, and it made sense. And it was, you know, obviously it landed well with sales and customers really bought into it, and it really took off. So, you know, I'd love to say that we absolutely knew what we were doing back then, but honestly, we were a little lucky. But it worked out really well. And now I see the signals in the market today, and I'm like, that's a category creation opportunity. There's an opportunity to tell a bigger story, much like how I think Drift is a great example. Drift, you know, in the chatbot world, they're telling a bigger story around just, you know, naming forms of the enemy and really saying we're a solution to better customer experience on your website by not making people fill out forms. That's a smart way to create a category. And I thought, you know, they're now the category leader in their space. And so anytime I see that now in the marketplace, I see it for what it is, you know, category creation.
And you mentioned that you would had in hindsight, you would have done things smarter. What are those things that you would have done better, knowing what you know now?
I would have invested deeper. I think we built Sitecore is almost all built organically. So basically built on our own revenue. We bootstrapped the whole nine yards. And now if I thought about it, I said, you know, we probably should have taken more money. We probably should have done faster acquisitions. We probably should have grown faster. We were very conservative, the Danish company, and we were really thoughtful about how we grew. It was still growing really well. I think over the years I were there, it was like a compound annual growth rate of like 40%. So it's still very good. But I feel like now looking back, hindsight, we should have taken a bigger investment round. We should have opened a war chest and really grown faster.
So basically taking more risks.
Take more risk and pour more gas on the fire.
Gotcha. And how do you go about creating a new category?
It starts with a story. As always, it starts with a good story, and the compelling story has to be like what's changed in the world, and what is it that you do or your product does that is going to solve and help navigate through that change. And in Sitecore's case, it was that customers are demanding consistency across experiences. They're demanding personalized experiences. They're demanding that you know them, and we were able to tell that story. So whatever the category is, it has to line up to like the change in the world and why customers need it. What happens if they don't do it? What happens, the benefits if they do do it, and how you uniquely solve those problems. And that category, that's how you really build that category. And again, it has to be a problem people really have. Like you can't invent these things. They have to be real problems. But if you can find that problem that is big enough, and you can tell that story about how it is that problem for them, there's a huge risk that they don't do something, and here's how you solve it for them. That's how you create a category.
Gotcha. So find the problem, create the story, and then solve that problem for the customer. And is there a category that you foresee happening in the next like 5 years?
One of the things I've seen out there that there's a big change. There's always technology sea changes, and one of the big sea changes I'm starting to notice is the move to messaging. I think email's not going to go away, but I think the rise of mobile messaging is really interesting. Particularly generational wise. The Gen Zs and millennials, they don't talk on the phone anymore. They text. They send messages, right? I can't get my daughter to ever call me. It's always a snap or a message, and so I think that's a very generational shift. And I think you'll see over the future there's going to be a huge shift as a channel, as a dominant channel. The new messages is I think that is going to be a big shift in how people interact with brands. And so I like to call it conversational experience, because it is very conversational based. It's very back and forth. It's very and there's going to be technology in there. It's going to be AI and bots, but I also think they're going to be humans there, because I don't think you can over automate that, because we still want a human experience at the end of the day. But I see that as the big next dominant channel, because that's getting smarter and smarter. You can buy things in a chat now. You can literally have a conversation with somebody, a salesperson, and they can put a cart in your chat, and you can buy it in the chat. Like you can click on an ad and say, "Hey, would you like to talk to somebody from this ad that of this product you really like?" And so more and more, this becoming this really rich channel where you interact with, and you can do it all there. And you don't have to jump to a website or have a broken link or have all these things that can go wrong today in typical commerce. So I think that is an interesting change. It's not there yet. It's still forming, but I see that as the next big shift.
Yeah, I mean, you see people get, the new generation, they almost get offended if you call them. It's like, why are you being so invasive? Like, you can send me a text message.
Totally.
Yeah, and I've been seeing that there's AI now that are being invented where you can talk to them. And there was one in particular, I can't remember the name of it, where it passed like 99% accuracy that people thought they were talking to a real human. And it ended up being a robot, an AI behind the chatbot. So it's really fascinating where this is heading to. It's almost kind of scary. Like you don't know who you're actually talking to on the other side. It could be a person. It could be a robot. You just don't know.
Yeah, the actual term for that is called the Turing test, named after Alan Turing, a British computer scientist, and he had cr invented this test to see like, is this actually a machine or a person? And so I think that's the real question. That 99.9% is, they're very close to passing the Turing test with these new bots.
Yeah, that's kind of scary. So let's jump over to one of your other experiences at Crown Peak. I read on your bio that you were hired to transform an underperforming business. So what were the steps that you took to grow that business, and how can other product leaders replicate that success?
Sometimes it's about building features. Sometimes it's about understanding what's driving churn. And so you really, when you enter a business, the first thing I always do is look at the revenue waterfall. Where's revenue coming in? Where's revenue going out? And in a Crown Peak case, we had years of sort of stagnant and actual decline in revenue. Because customers were frustrated, and we hadn't really kept up with the times. I think the product had fallen behind the market, and the customers were getting frustrated and leaving, and we weren't bringing in enough revenue on the top to make up for the what's going out the bottom. And I think when you're in that kind of situation, then you really have to just spend a lot of time talking to your customers, really understand what frustrates them, what do they see as table stakes. You know, a lot of times people want to go build shiny new things, but sometimes what you should go build is table stakes. Now, I'm a big fan of balancing, you know, the mix of table stakes and really keeping up with the market with a little bit of innovation. I do think like having exciter features and value creation features are an important in the mix. But it doesn't help, like, you know, putting jet engines on a Yugo doesn't help. Like sometimes you need to make sure that the car is roadworthy first before you try and soup it up. And so in the case of Crown Peak, it was really about shoring it up, really solving for the stability problems, solving for, you know, the table stakes, making sure things worked in the way customers wanted, and really solving the base use case. And then we were able to focus on value add things that really drove a lot of value, got customers excited, which is what we always want to work on in product, right? We always want to work on the exciting features, you know, and you want to build cool AI into things, but sometimes it's just about the blocking and tackling. And so that was a lot of the work is let's fix the, you know, the base stuff. Let's get the core stabilized. Let's make sure customers are happy. You know, we worked real hard on NPS, real hard on what we called customer effort score, you know, how the perceived effort to implement things and to use the product, and hammered away at that quarter after quarter until it got better. And we started to true up the, you know, right the ship and really start growing again.
So you mentioned quarter after quarter, you're fixing the base of what the customer actually wants. But when do you actually get to the fun part? You know, when do you get to actually building the, you know, features that are essentially fun to build?
Yeah, it took us about a year of stabilization till we could get to some of the more fun stuff. But the other thing that we used is our partner channels and our ISV network, because sometimes as much as you want to build everything, you don't have to build everything. Sometimes it's about partnering with folks who are adjacent to you. And maybe you want to build that one day, but you don't have the time to do it now or the resources. So you can partner in the short term. And so we did a lot of that too. And so we built partnerships and really built a confederation of integrated tools so that customers could still achieve what they wanted. It just wasn't always on our product. It was us plus another vendor to solve for various different problems. And so we use a lot of kind of ecosystem approaches to solve the greater problem set without having to write all of those. So we got a lot of that exciter stuff, but we didn't actually build all of it. We just were able to assemble it and bring it to bear and solve the customer problem, but it just wasn't all our stuff.
Gotcha. So let's dive into that a little bit more, into the ecosystem. It's like, as a product leader, you know, when do you decide to like integrate with another application for efficiency and for efficiency versus building that feature in-house? Because it's easy to integrate a bunch of applications into your product, but at some point, doesn't that get really clunky? So what's the right balance? Mm-hmm.
So I always run build by partner analyses on all the major functional areas. And the question you have to ask yourself is like, first of all, is this feature core to our value, core to our use case? If it is core to your business, then you need to own it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you can't own it right now, you can partner for a period of time, but you need to eventually own it. So I think that's the first analysis. If it's something that is important and you can't get to it right now, but you really need it, you should acquire. You should buy it. If you can, you should acquire it. And then if it's let's call it a peripheral use case or an adjacent use case, is something that you don't think you're going to get to in the next 2 years, but it's still an important capability in your deals, and you're losing deals because you don't have it, and maybe your competitors do, then that's a really solid, you know, opportunity to either partner or OEM. You could also OEM. And I think running build by partner analyses is really good hygiene for everything. Because, you know, the tendency for product people, again, is to build everything. And sometimes it's just not core to your business. In terms of the clunkiness, I think the smart way to do a lot of those integrations is to build, you know, an integration layer with an ecosystem, with an app store, or really, really be thoughtful about how you design for it. Really make this a pluggable environment. Like when you use tools, like everyday tools like Zoom, right? When you're using a tool like Zoom, they have a very nice, ecosystem and an app store that plugs in and feels very native. So you can build these things in a way that is very close to native, and you can hold your partners to design standards. So I think you can still architect for uniformity and consistency, but have this, have all these extensions that work really well. Think about everyday use on, Apple Store, the App Store. They have built their business on not owning almost all of the functionality that runs on their phones. So I think that there's a case to be made that, you get a lot of value when you can build an ecosystem that solves a lot of problems. Salesforce is another great example. They've done a great job of their app, AppExchange, really extending the use cases they can solve for their customers, but not actually having to own all that code.
Yeah, I mean, you're saving certainly a lot of time by not having to own every single feature. So remind me again, so you want to build it out if it's core to your values. You want to acquire if it's something that you need right away. And then you want to partner when it's something that's down the line, maybe to your timeline.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you're never going to do it. You're never going to do it, but it's important to your customers.
Gotcha.
Because strategy is what you don't do.
Strategy is not. Okay. Understood. And just jumping over, you do have a long list of accomplishments, and I'm sure the audience is on the edge of their seat to know, what is your secret sauce?
What is the secret sauce? I think a lot of it has to just do with being open and helpful. So I've been asked before, how did I get where I got? And I think the answer is being useful, being helpful, right? And really finding ways to be, to be of use to others and serve others. And that sounds a little crazy, but if you think about servant leadership and really what makes great teams, it's leaders are the ones that actually make the space and create the opportunity for their teams to flourish. And so in my career, I've always tried to find ways to help people flourish. And even if they're not on my team, I'm always trying to find ways to be helpful and useful, because when you succeed, we succeed. So I've always found that has been like going to the place where there's greatest need and being helpful is where I think I've gotten the most advantage in my career. And just seeing like when something needs to be done, just do it. Even if it's not your job, just do it. Lean in and be helpful and be useful. And that seems very, very trivial, but that really is what I've done that's led to where I've gotten.
But how do you balance that, right? Because you have your set of work that you need to get done, but then you're also extending out that help. So mm-hmm. How do you manage your time?
Yeah, I mean, it's a balance, right? You've got to, sometimes you need to know when to say no. But if you can, when you can, you should. I think that's maybe the best way to frame it. If you've got capacity, and hopefully nobody's running 100%, right? You don't want to be running people, and you don't want to be running your teams at the red line either. That's a recipe for burnout. I like to create space for teams where they're never working hard. Google's approach of, have 80% and then let people, work with the rest and trust your teams. I think that's important. So I try to manage my own time and my own space and my own teams in that same way so that we have some capacity to innovate and not just get sucked up in the day-to-day.
Gotcha. And speaking of time, I know in our first conversation, we mentioned, we talked about time boxing. Like, what does that mean? And let's start there. What does time boxing mean?
Time boxing is something that when you don't know how long something's going to take, you can just say, all right, I'm just going to give this 3 sprints. I'm going to give this, 2 weeks to try things. I'm going to get what I can get done in that time frame. And I think this goes to the conversation that we were having about like how do you drive a test and learn culture, and how do you balance this idea of testing and learning with predictability. Like, because a lot of times people want a roadmap and they want to know like what date is this feature going to be done, but sometimes you don't know because sometimes you're trying to learn. And as Melissa Perry talks about in the Build Trap, minimum viable learning, how quickly can you learn and get signals so you can iterate? So time boxing is a way to say, all right, I'm going to give these 3 teams 6 weeks out of my quarter to iterate on this problem. And I'm going to try a bunch of solutions. I've got a bunch of prototypes. I'm going to try them in a very lightweight way. And I'm going to see which ones work and which ones are failing. And I'm gonna double down on the ones that are working, and I'm gonna allocate, but I'm gonna pull the plug at 6 weeks, and then we're gonna stop, recess, and we'll get back to some other, you know, other work that requires, you know, predictability. But it's that balance between agility and predictability. And so time boxing is a way to kind of have both.
Gotcha. So time boxing allows you to be rapid, be agile, and yet have that predictability of like, we're going to go in there, we're going to learn. But you mentioned 6 weeks. Is that usually your the time frame that you usually give your team, or did you just pull that number? If so, like, how do you determine? Yeah. So then how do you determine how long is enough to have that predictability?
Just made that number up. Yeah, it took us a couple of tries to figure it out. And sometimes you have some level of estimate from your engineering counterpart. And so your engineering counterpart like, all right, we think it's gonna take at least, we want to try 3 iterations of this, it's gonna probably take us 4 weeks or 6 weeks, or they'll give you some kind of estimate. And it'll be directionally right, but mostly wrong. So you just you throw that in and you get what you can get done.
Gotcha. So do you ever have time boxes where you're spending maybe a few days to a max a week on certain features, certain outcomes?
You know, and it's usually at least a sprint. It's almost always at least a sprint worth of effort. But you know, we've seen lots of hackathons where people have come up with amazing things in 3 days. So, sometimes a forcing function can generate magic.
Gotcha. I ask because I know a lot of early stage startups, they're always in this mindset of ASAP. Like, you know, we just want to get it done. Give it 1 week. Let's see where we go. So I'm just wondering if there's any trick to how long or how little time you're supposed to give your team when you're trying to execute something new.
Yeah, I think every team organizes differently.
Especially when you're in that learning.
Yeah, especially small startups, when you're trying to find product market fit, like, you know, week iteration, week sprints is totally reasonable, right? Because you're moving, you're a small team, you're sitting probably 15 feet from each other, and you're working through things really quickly, and you know, and you've got shippable code, you know, on a weekly basis. That could totally make sense. I mean, it just depends on the org and the structure and how big. You know, Hootsuite was definitely a later stage company that, you know, and we all also had enterprise customers who got cranky if you ship too much stuff too fast. Like they are the opposite. Like slow down. This is too much change for us. So there's sometimes you have to balance those things too.
Gotcha. And how do you measure the success of time boxing, or how do you measure the success of this?
So depending on what you're trying to test, you're going to forecast some metric. You're going to say, this is going to improve. I'm trying to, my success metric is X. And many times for us, we were always trying to improve our trial to paid conversion rates. So the biggest barometer of our success is, did this move the needle on getting people to convert more? Or did this move the needle on how well customers activated? Like, did they use the product in the first handful of days? Did they hit that aha habit moment? Things that told us, A, that like they see the value of the product, and B, they use it enough that it becomes habitual, so they'll stay. And so we had a couple of metrics, and then there's other kind of metrics you want to look at, like adoption rates. Like, is this attaining the level of adoption we thought it would, and is that the right curve? So you use a handful of metrics to kind of plot like success or failure, and things that can be rapidly gained. You can see them quickly enough so that you can know, do I need another iteration on this, or is this good for now, and I'll move on to the next thing.
Gotcha. And these are metrics that you're determining before getting started.
You make a forecast. Like, you say, I believe that this is going to improve it by X or Y. And of course, sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes, like, the, you know, it's too high. And sometimes you're totally too low. Like, there's one time when we thought it would be like a 2% improvement. It was an 8% improvement. We're like, holy cow. And that's a big, I mean, those kind of improvements can be really meaningful. It could be millions and millions of dollars.
Gotcha. And so for a larger company or later stage, later stage company like Hootsuite, what are some of the things that product leaders should be aware to measure? Like, I know that's different for every company, but what would you say are some of the top things that these product managers should keep in mind, that, hey, we got to make sure that these things are continuously being measured and we're moving the needle forward.
Well, I'm a huge fan of things like customer effort score, right? That just kind of goes to like how easy it's brought to use. NPS can be interesting as a quarterly, semi-annual number, just like how happy your customers are. I think getting customers to be habitual in their use, you know, getting them using the product and activated, however you want to measure that, like whether that's using a tool like Reforge Framework, talks about this aha and habit moment, and using those, and then also just the ongoing engagement levels. Like there's how, you know, how much is a customer using? Are they using your customer for more than one use case? How deeply are they using it? How broadly are they using your product? There's all those kinds of measures that say, are they actually engaging with the product more deeply? And is that engagement deepening? Those are great things to be measuring and watching. Because ultimately you also want to understand, you know, are they buying more? They're using more, are they buying more? And that goes to, you know, improving your NRR, net recurring revenue. And so ultimately that's the goal, is that you get them to stay, use, stay, and buy more. And so measuring all those things are probably the things that I as a product leader like to sign up for. And then of course, thinking about churn and what is driving, you know, I'll call it product churn, right? There's different kinds of churn, right? But the churn that is derived from customers being dissatisfied with the product, and, you know, and reducing that as much as you can.
Gotcha. So it almost sounds like your primary focus is on that engagement. You know, just to reiterate, it's about how broad the users are using your product, how much engagement is coming in, or how often they're using it, and revenue is almost as a result of that engagement, and then churn also being a result of lack of engagement.
Right. Yeah, that we found that when customers didn't do a certain set of actions, you know, in the first X number of days or first month, you know, the churn was 20% higher and things like that. So when you start to, you know, and having data analysts working with your product teams is wonderful, because they can show you what those inflection points are. They can tell you what those key activities are. They're really getting to those moments and then saying, okay, we need to actually make this thing happen more often, and that will improve our retention. Things like that can really be useful, but that's very company dependent.
Gotcha. And we're almost coming up on time, but I wanted to shift the focus more on, you know, what are some of the advice, like what are some final advice or anything that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to share with the community?
You know, and you probably hear this from lots of the thought leaders in this world and product, but falling in love with the problem is the most useful thing, and resisting, you know, obsessing about the solution, because sometimes it's easy to be really falling in love with your own solution versus really falling in love with the customer problem and obsessing over how to solve it. And I mean, bringing a beginner's mindset to the job, because, you know, a beginner can see a million ways to do things, but an expert will see about one. Be the beginner and have the beginner's mindset, like be exploring the many ways you can solve the problem, particularly asking why a lot, so you get to the real problem, and then really obsessing about solving that problem in the many ways you can solve it, and realize that the first solution you have, it's probably not the right one, probably not going to be as good as you thought it would be, and you're going to have to iterate a couple of times. Most of the breakout features that we released in the last 2 years, it took us four turns before we actually found the right mix that got adoption, that drove success. So don't get too fixated on the solution. Just be thinking about the problem and keep iterating until you really hit it.
That sounds like a common theme of, you know, how you got to your success. You mentioned it earlier on that, you know, you want to get to solving the customer's real problem, and how you get there is just keep asking the why, like, why are we solving this and why are we here? And once you do that, then you can actually start iterating on the solution. So I love that you share that again towards the end of the podcast, because it kind of comes back in full circle.
Yep. Words to live by.
Any other advice that you'd like to share with the audience before we close out?
Read more books. Become a lifelong learner. That's my other piece of advice. I wish I didn't read a lot of books in my 30s and even early 40s. And it wasn't until like 40s, 50s that I started becoming voracious and reading books that are on product and design and psychology. Thinking Fast and Slow is a psychology book. But I've just really fallen in love with learning, and that just makes you think differently and makes you a better person.
I love that. So I know I've asked you early on what's the book that everyone must read. Give me your top five career changing or thought changing books that you would recommend.
Escaping the Bill Trap from Melissa Perry was a big thought changer. I think Thinking Fast and Slow, because it helps understand how people process decisions. And there's the fast brain, which is sort of the instinctual brain, and there's the slow brain, the thoughtful brain. But understanding the mechanics was very interesting. I think How to Win Friends and Influence People, Dale Carnegie, an oldie but a goodie. I think that was another one that read, a little later in life than I probably should have, but wonderful. And 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, I think, was also a huge, a huge kind of business kind of mindset shift for me.
I love that book.
And then I think the on the strategy front, Art of Action. I think Art of Action is a strategy book that everyone should read.
Art of Action. I love it. Okay. Yeah, out of those, the one that I did read was the 7 Habits. It took me about 2 years to actually get through that book, but I think it's so applicable across board, whether you're in business or just life. Especially that first chapter about reframing your whole perspective. I think that's so invaluable to anybody, because we often get stuck in this like purpose life should be.
Yeah, that his son is just wrote a book I'm reading right now, called Trust and Inspire. So Stephen M. Covey wrote this book, but it very much is he's his father's son, and it's a great book because it's about a leader and how, as a leader, you need to trust you need to trust your team, and you need to inspire your teams. And so it's a great book, and it's got a lot of his dad in him around the 7 Habits and all that. So I'm really enjoying that right now.
Oh, I love it. I'll definitely pick that up then. Well, Darren, thank you so much for your time today. I've certainly learned a lot from you about how to be a great product leader. And if someone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to reach you?
So I'm on Twitter at D Gornacha, and of course LinkedIn, also slash D Gornacha, and then my email is just Darren at Gornacha.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Darren, and thank you, Wander Fam, for listening. Stay tuned for more episodes on design, product management, and innovation. Experience, educate, and grow to live your best lives. Thanks, everyone.